This is Lewis Lapham with The World in Time. My guest is Brooke Walensky-Lanford, speaking with us today about the searches for the biblical Garden of Eden. Your new book, Brooke, comes with the title Paradise Lust, by which I take you to mean the lusting after a place, not a person. Where on earth was the garden named in the book of Genesis? You say that it has been variously located not only in modern Iraq, but also underwater in the Mediterranean Sea, in Berlin, Jerusalem, California, and at the North Pole. When and why did you begin your own searching for the forbidden fruit and the tree of knowledge?
It started for me with a family rumor. My dad, just in passing, happened to mention that my great uncle, who I'd never met, had been looking for the Garden of Eden. Now, all I knew about this great uncle was that he lived on the Upper East Side and he was an allergist at Columbia's Medical Center. And I had no idea that he was even, you know, a church-going person at all. And so I thought, this is odd. What makes him think that this is a real place that he can go? Where did he think he was going and what did he think he would find? This was in the 1950s that my uncle was apparently looking. I tried to find out as much as I could from my family, but it was sort of considered a little quirk or sort of a strange family, you know, rumor, and nobody knew much more than that. So it set me on this search to find out why throughout history people think that they can find this place that's mythical, legendary. And in the book of Genesis, there are four verses that give a really for the Bible, pretty specific description of the geography of Eden. They describe four rivers that go out from the garden. Those four rivers are named. They're the Tigris, the Euphrates, and the Pishon and the Gihon. Now, most of us know where the Tigris and Euphrates are. Almost nobody has any idea where the Pishon and the Gihon are or were. There's all kinds of theories about what those names actually refer to. But it's a very straightforward description. It says, you know, this river goes to the land of Cush, where you can find this and that. And this in itself has become sort of a blueprint or maybe a Rorschach test for the seekers who look for Eden. They look at it and they take it and interpret it in myriad different ways.
Let's talk about the ancient searching and the modern searching. When does the searching begin? Early days of Christianity in medieval Europe? When?
It goes all the way back to Augustine and probably farther. Certainly he was the one who popularized the idea that Eden could be found. He sort of gave people permission to look. He said this was a real place and we can find it. During the Age of Exploration, that the search for the Garden of Eden carried through that. There was a monk who made it all the way to Sri Lanka, what's now Sri Lanka, in 1358, you know, and thought he had found the garden there. Of course, Columbus thought he had found the Garden of Eden in the middle of South America, near the mouth of the Orinoco, was his theory.
What was Columbus's theory of the shape of the world?
Well, funny you should ask. He felt that the shape of the world was like a giant breast, and that paradise would, of course, be the nipple. Paradise is on a very tall mountain, of course, because it has to have survived Noah's flood. So that's the reason for that shape. And the breast-shaped earth was sort of a quirk of Columbus that didn't really take off, I think you could say.
Was he hoping to conquer Eden for Spain?
Yeah, he thought it would be a great weapon of conversion, right? You know, if Spain has found the garden, we should all be Christians, and proves everything is true. So he was looking to colonize everything, of course. But at the time that he was writing to Ferdinand and Isabella about this, he was also probably suffering from syphilis-induced madness, is the latest theory. So he didn't get very far with that one.
What about Dürer's painting of Adam and Eve in the garden?
It became, really for me, a symbol of the sort of classical, biblical myth that was out there, these idealized figures of Adam and Eve who are really based on Greek and Roman models in the way that they're posed. They're sort of perfectly rounded and idealized. And then in that image, there are all these symbolic animals gathered around the two of them, which all I believe they represent the four humors. So it's all very stylized. And that image was sort of what Europe, medieval and Enlightenment Europe had in mind, I think, when they saw the Garden of Eden. It was widely popularized.
19th century modern search, how does that begin? And that gives rise to people going off in many directions.
Yes. You know, when I first started looking for Eden, I sort of figured that the search would stop right about there in the medieval period. But lo and behold, surprise, it did not. I was, I guess, expecting it to sort of end with Darwin, right? Because, of course, his theories took a long time to develop and take hold. But, you know, I figured once it was pretty clear that man did not begin all at once, boom, in one place, on one spot in the world, that the search for Eden would fizzle away. But it turns out that I would say actually the opposite occurred. As new science about human origins was coming to light at the end of the 19th century, it actually seemed to spur the old search forward. People with religious backgrounds or religious education trying to make sense of the new science and the new discoveries and sort of weave them into their ideas of the world in these very creative ways.
Talk about the president of Boston University and his locating of Eden.
He's quite a character. William Fairfield Warren, who is a Methodist theologian and also the first president of Boston University. He was an interesting guy. He was a university president and also a theologian. So he was a progressive person, and he advocated for, like, women going into the priesthood and all kinds of unusual things.
And what years are we in here?
I'm sorry, we're in 1880s. So he wrote this book in 1881 called Paradise Found, which took 433 pages to explain in great detail why the Garden of Eden had been at the North Pole. This is sort of a surprising idea. But he's a great example of somebody knitting together new science and old religious ideas. He started with one true fact, which is that once upon a time, long, long ago, the North Polar region would have been warmer. This is apparently true. That's all he needed to start concocting this amazing theory that he brings together, where once upon a time, the North Pole was tropical, you know, that it was populated with woolly mammoths and sequoias and giant Adam and Eve who had all kinds of superpowers, you know. And then once they committed original sin, God flooded the North Pole and it froze. And as it froze, Adam and Eve made their way south to populate the earth from the north. And over the course of generations, they lost their superpowers and were no longer giants. As they moved farther and farther from the garden, from perfection, they became like us. They became us. So it's this story of the origin of humanity that starts at the top of the earth and spreads slowly and evenly down in four equal streams, representing, of course, those four rivers of paradise, spreads down to become the civilization that we have today. That's his story.
The older Eden is still buried somewhere way, way below the ice.
Way, way down there, yeah.
Was his theory taken seriously in the 1880s?
It was. I mean, the book was I think, reprinted 18 times. He went on the lecture circuit talking about this, and he was, you know, I think it was a little bit of a novelty idea even then, but he was a very forceful personality and a major theologian, and people paid attention. It also, his theories came at a time when there was just a rage for Arctic exploration in the late 1880s. Nobody had actually been yet to the North Pole, and there was a lot of public excitement over these giant exhibitions that, you know, would be hugely expensive and dramatic and would spend weeks and weeks trying to find the North Pole, and, you know, a lot of them ended tragically, and there was controversy about whether the government should continue even to fund these expeditions. So he actually played into that. He was an advocate for more exploration and for more science and for more finding out what was really there.
The modern idea, but most of the modern locations of Eden have been somewhere in Iraq, somewhere around the ancient Babylonia, near the rivers Tigris and Euphrates. Talk about some of the archaeologists, Assyriologists who searched for it there.
Yeah, there is a long history of archaeology and actually also a religious tradition because of those verses of the Bible. John Calvin was the first person to include a map of that part of the Middle East in his Bible, you know, to really connect it to the place on the ground. One of the seekers who I write about in the book who's would call himself an Assyriologist was a turn of the century German scientist who wrote a book actually around the same time as William Warren, describing how in actually what would come to be a fairly accepted theory that the stories of the Bible came from much older Babylonian and Sumerian myths and legends. And he was able to uncover actual stone tablets and learn the symbolic language to translate them. And he found amazing stories that, you know, echo the Bible in all kinds of ways. But his theories were controversial because, of course, you know, the Bible was written down by Moses, transcribed directly from God, and anything getting in between those things was controversial. He was later proven to be correct in that.
And what about the man named Sayce?
Sayce. He's a great character. He was a major Assyriologist who was famous for his work with the Hittite people and learned their language. He was the only person who learned their language with this particular tribe and in a particular part of Mesopotamia. So he was a very well-respected scholar, but he also became a defender of, he believed that archaeology could vindicate the truth of the Bible. The more tablets you discover that may seem to indicate that the Bible came from older legends, maybe that's not true. Maybe, you know, he concocted all these theories about how the Hebrews came upon these legends and they were actually written down by Moses. And so he tried to preserve that religious idea of coming straight from the lips of God in the scientific era.
How successful was he in that attempt?
He actually was a great success. There was a form of entertainment in late 19th century London called Examples from Tablets. It was like a stage show, you know, where you'd have these giant reconstructions of Babylonian tablets, and then you'd have your Bible, and somebody would be up there explaining to you how these two were connected, and they became all the rage. And he became this popularizer of biblical archaeology. He wrote basically tracts promoting archaeology for the sake of the Bible. That was a message that a lot of people wanted to hear, right? That these two things can be reconciled.
Was there ever a clear decision as to what was the tree? What kind of a tree was the tree of knowledge? And what was the fruit that Eve took part of?
A clear decision. Well, I wish I could tell you that there was. Of course, we all sort of grew up with this notion in our heads that it was an apple tree that Eve ate from, but the word apple is nowhere in the Bible. The word fruit is there, and so throughout history there have been many, many interpretations of what that fruit could have been. There's a lot of fig, pomegranate possibilities. The German Assyriologist who I mentioned earlier was a big fan of the date palm because, of course, that tree is a very present symbol throughout Mesopotamia. He also had a great reason why it couldn't be the fig tree, because fig tree leaves were too small to do the necessary covering up. So it had to be a date palm, perhaps a banana palm. That was his theory.
In the 20th century now, I mean, are there searches for Eden still going on? Is it still to be found somewhere, let's say, in Kentucky or Georgia?
I think those are good bets. Yes, Kentucky and Georgia are beautiful places. The search is definitely still going on. It's changed character over time, less about seeking out unknown places like the North Pole and more about preserving the places that we do have that are perfect and unspoiled. That's the character it's taken on recently. One of my favorite modern Eden seekers would be Thor Heyerdahl, who a lot of people have heard of for his Kon-Tiki expedition in 1947. 30 years later than that, sort of one of his later voyages, he went to Iraq to the place where the Tigris and Euphrates meet and built a raft, or a full boat made out of the one particular reed that grows in the Mesopotamian marshes. And this was in the late 70s in, you know, Saddam Hussein's Iraq. And he, you know, he had to make it through all the minders and everything that they would send with him into the marshes to go get these reeds. He was completely sincere in his belief that he could find an origin of civilization story, that he could go back to where the ancient Sumerians built these boats, and he could prove that they interacted with other ancient civilizations and were a cooperative society. And through that, he could, you know, inspire world cooperation today. So he's still trying.
What about the Creation Museum?
Again, when I started this project, I really was having trouble reconciling the notion that my great uncle had been looking for the Garden of Eden because I thought of him as Mr. Science. And I thought, well, anybody looking for the Garden of Eden would have to be sort of an ultra-conservative biblical literalist reading of the Bible. And so I thought, well, those guys must have a Garden of Eden, right? Because they take everything at its word, so they must have one. So I went to the Creation Museum, which is in Kentucky, and observed all the animatronic dinosaurs and read all the plaques explaining how the Earth was only 6,000 years old and that humans and dinosaurs both made it onto Noah's Ark, and it all went from there. And I was totally bowled over by this. It was very difficult to comprehend. And then I finally made it to the Garden of Eden, where there were, in fact, animatronic dinosaurs being waited on by Adam. There was a line of creatures waiting to be named by Adam, including a dinosaur and an ape, and also a penguin, for some reason. So they had this very specific theme park sort of vision of the Garden of Eden, but they actually specifically refused to place it on the map, which I found surprising and fascinating. Their position, and it makes sense in a biblical literal kind of way, is that the Garden of Eden must have been destroyed by Noah's flood, as in fact their vision is the whole earth was destroyed and completely reshaped and remade, and that's how we get continents and that's how we get fossils. It all goes back to Noah's flood for the creationists. So to put the Garden of Eden on the globe for them would be to say that Noah's flood was not a total disaster because we can know something from before the flood. They don't believe you can know anything from before the flood. And I actually found this a little disappointing. You know, I'd gotten to the point reading all these more idiosyncratic earlier seekers who were just so determined to put Eden on the map. And they had all these really interesting motivations that were about the here and now and the earthly. Whereas the creation museums seem to be attached to some idea of global destruction and catastrophe and, you know, Noah's flood destroyed the earth and the earth will be destroyed again in the apocalypse. You know, it was a kind of a sad vision, I felt, compared to some of these earlier seekers.
After all of your own researches, do you come away with the thought that there is an Eden somewhere, if only we look hard enough?
Yes. You know, people have asked me when I explain the different seekers that I've looked for, well, who found Eden or did anybody find the Garden of Eden? And I have to say, well, yes, they all found it, right? Because what you're doing when you find Eden is sort of creating a blueprint for your story of the world, where we began, how great it was, what we did wrong, and where we're going to go from here. It's all encapsulated in that Eden story. So I think there are many Edens, if that's not a cop-out of an answer. But I think Eden is about that perfect place that we all sort of have a sense of nostalgia for.
Therefore, Eden is a work in progress.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Brooke Walensky-Lanford, for speaking with us today about the searching for the Garden of Eden. I'm Lewis Lapham with Lapham's Quarterly for Bloomberg News, copyright Bloomberg 2011.